time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Pamela Olson. Pamela Olson lived in Ramallah for 2 years, during which she served as head writer and editor for the Palestine Monitor and foreign press coordinator for Dr. Mustafa Barghouti's 2005 presidential campaign. She's published stories and articles in Counterpunch, Electronic Intifada, Mondo Weiss, Israel's Occupation Magazine, and The Standard Magazine. And she is here to talk about her new book, Fast Times in Palestine, A Love Affair with a Homeless Homeland. Pam, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
So start out, tell us, what was your motivation in writing your book, Fast Times in Palestine?
Well, the motivation was, when I visited Palestine unexpectedly in 2003, I never expected to visit there at all. I was backpacking from Cairo to Istanbul, and I planned to skip the Holy Land, you know, partly because it seemed really complex and partly because it was actually more expensive than the other, you know, countries I was visiting. But once I kind of stepped foot in that place and, you know, witnessed, first of all, the kind welcome of the Palestinians and, you know, how warm and funny and, savvy and interesting and educated and, like, even well-traveled people were, even in this small village called Jayus, I was really intrigued. And then, you know, very quickly I began to witness what's being done to these, to the Palestinians with, you know, the wall cutting them off from their land and, the checkpoints and the routine harassment and everybody's stories from, you know, what had been happening to their families for years. And, you know, then I visited a friend in Israel and I told him about what I had seen, and he was almost as shocked as I was to hear about the stories I was telling him. Even though I lived literally about 5 miles from the Green Line, from the West Bank, he knew very little about what ordinary everyday life was like for the people just across the, just on the other side of the fence. And so I actually brought him to Jayus to show him, you know, first of all, the people that, you know, were, he halfway expected to just sort of cross the fence and there's men with masks on and Kalashnikovs just waiting for him to cross the border, you know, to cause him problems. But, of course, they're like, they hid his car for him because he had Israeli license plates and he wasn't technically allowed to visit this Palestinian village called Jayus. And they were, like, practicing Hebrew with him and practicing Russian with him because he was Russian-Israeli. And, you know, he was both as charmed and as shocked at the things that he was seeing with the wall and everything. And so that was kind of like my first couple of weeks in the Holy Land, you know. And then from there, it just, there were so many things I witnessed, so many amazing times that I had, and so many political realities that I witnessed as a journalist and later as the foreign press coordinator for a Palestinian presidential candidate that made up this story that's so intriguing and so important as well, but that nobody was telling that I could see. So I wanted to try to tell that story.
Did you have, were you political prior to getting involved?
Not particularly. I was a physics major at Stanford, and I was interested actually originally in alternative energy. And the more I sort of studied and learned about it, the more I realized that it was actually a political issue. Like, you can make the best invention for clean energy you want, but if all the political will is towards subsidizing other, you know, dirtier technologies, then you're kind of dead in the water. And then so then I ended up getting a minor in political science and also studying abroad in Moscow, where, you know, it was interesting because nobody in Moscow is, silly enough to believe without any kind of critical thinking whatsoever, you know, what their press and government tell them. So it was kind of like briskly refreshing compared to the U.S., where everybody watches CNN and they assume everything is exactly as they say and all this kind of thing. And, you know, I would read or hear about what's, you know, the leaders of Russia were saying, and then I would talk to Chechen refugees or mothers of Russian soldiers, or, you know, later when I took the train through Siberia, I met the soldiers themselves who were telling their stories of being in this meat grinder. And I guess you can say that sort of started to politicize me. And it was part of the reason also that I visited the Middle East, because, you know, 9/11 happened right before I graduated, and then the Iraq War is starting up, and, you know, I just had a feeling that I'm being lied to. I'm being bamboozled. I'm like, my intelligence is being insulted. But unfortunately, I didn't know anything. Yeah, I couldn't come back with anything because I didn't know anything about Islam or about the Middle East or about any of these things. So part of why I wanted to visit the Middle East was to fill in some of those holes. And like I say, I just wanted to do touristy things. That was plenty plenty for me, plenty adventurous enough for me. But by the time I was kind of comfortable in the Middle East, and then I started meeting journalists and foreign aid workers in Amman, Jordan, they were telling all these stories of history happening right next door in Iraq and right next door in Palestine, and completely different than what I had been told by my own press and government. And, you know, Winston Churchill said, some men stumble into the truth now and then, but most of them pick up and keep going as if nothing had happened. And I didn't want to be one of those people, so I sort of stopped to investigate, and sure enough, 10 years later, I'm still working on the issue.
How did you land the gig as being a writer and editor at the Palestine Monitor?
That's a great question. I certainly wasn't qualified to do so, and when they, you know, I was volunteering with a Palestinian progressive political party called the Palestinian National Initiative, and you know, it was, you know, like I say, progressive. They were believed in equal rights for women and minorities and nonviolence. Like, their platform was based on international law. All of these things that checks all the boxes you'd think, you know, we in the United States would want in an Arab leader. So I wanted to explore, you know, was it going to succeed? If so, you know, great. I'd love to be a witness to that, be a part of that. Is it going to fail? If so, what are the forces arrayed against, you know, total moderates like Dr. Mustafa Barghouti in this kind of pressure cooker situation? So, so I was volunteering with that, and after about 3 months of volunteering, I get a call, and they say, hey, you know, the head writer and editor of the Palestine Monitor is stepping down. Do you want the job? And I was like, are you sure you have the right number? I'm a physics major, ex-bartender, volunteer. I just got here 3 months ago. Not sure I'm qualified to run a news organization. And they're like, oh, don't worry, you'll figure it out. So, you know, from the beginning, it was like drinking from a fire hose, just learning not only to be a journalist, but also all of the, you know, terminology and all the villages and what the villages are known for. And there's, you know, more political parties than most people have heard about. And you have to kind of triangulate what people are talking about when they're talking about the different parties, or and Israeli parties, too, for that matter. So, you know, it's the book is called Fast Times in Palestine, partly because, you know, every time I would get a little bit comfortable in whatever I was doing, I'd get thrown a complete curveball. And this is one of them.
Describe the Palestine Monitor more. What's the audience for that?
It's an English language news source, and the main audience is people in the U.S. and Europe who are not otherwise getting a clear picture from the Palestinian perspective of what life is like day to day and what the trends are of, you know, water use practices and settlement expansion and the way that the wall separates people from their land and home demolitions. And it makes no bones about the fact that it's primarily from the Palestinian perspective, unlike the U.S. media, which doesn't really admit in general that it's primarily from the Israeli perspective. But it was an attempt to kind of balance that a little bit.
And do you feel like you were your journalism when you were working there, was that objective or advocacy journalism or mix of both?
Sure. So every day, the first thing I would do every day is get a list of who had been killed the night before. For the time that I was there, on average, two people were killed every single day. And on average, a child was killed almost every other day. So there was that backlog of death almost every morning that you have to figure out who was killed, who killed them, why were they killed, how were they injured, all these kind of statistics about what, you know, this just routine killing that just went on day after day after day. And we tried to be as thorough, I mean, as objective as possible. Just here's the facts. Here's what happened. You know, we would call the hospital. We'd call the family. We would check the Israeli papers for what they said about it. We would check the UN if they had a report about it. We would check other newspapers and try to triangulate as best we could what we believed was the most objective truth in each case. And that was just the killing. And then there were many other things, too, that we tried to be as, you know, tried to, you know, show the truth from the Palestinian perspective as honestly as possible. And then occasionally we would have, like, you know, human interest stories, which would be straight up, this is what life is like for this family, or this is like what life is like for this village, or for this woman who was elected mayor of this village, and how did she become elected mayor, and what's it like watching men bring her tea and coffee? It's pretty nice, actually. So yeah, there was a lot of that.
And how long did you do that?
More than a year. I think I started in the fall of 2004, and I left Palestine at the very end of 2005.
Did you have any benefits from being part of the press then while you're working on that?
No, it's the opposite. If you're working for a news organization in general, you tend to get extra harassment at the Israeli borders. If I had told them, of course I didn't tell them, but if I had told them I worked for the Palestine Monitor, chances are I would have been deported pretty quickly. I mean, because I had to leave the territories controlled by Israel, which includes the West Bank, and come back in and get a new Israeli tourist visa every 3 months. And I had to be untruthful about what I was doing, because it's at their discretion whether they want to let you in or not. And many, many of my friends and coworkers have been, you know, deported because of the work they do. So it's definitely not a benefit. And as far as getting a work permit or a work visa, if you're living and working in the Palestinian territories, it's almost impossible to get that. So most of the foreigners live 3 months at a time, knowing that at any moment they can get turned back at the border or banned for 10 years or whatever. It's for that reason it's difficult to build a life, and that's what ultimately led me to leave. I couldn't handle the pressure of, you know, every single time the way that you're grilled and the way sometimes it's held for 8 hours at a time, and just the psychological difficulty that on top of all these brutality that you're witnessing and all these things that are happening, then you know that at any moment, if you say the wrong thing at the border, you can lose your job, you lose your house, you lose your things, you know, you lose your friends and your plans, and it got to be too much for me after a while.
So kind of a form of PTSD, or not as bad as that?
Yeah, I wouldn't go quite that far. It was just more, when so many impressions and so many emotions and so many things, like when you're living there, you have to learn to sublimate your emotions enough to, you know, get by and do your work. I mean, every single day waking up and the first thing you do is you have coffee and record death and destruction. You know, it gets pretty pretty psychologically difficult after a while. And in the book, I talk about several stories of my own friends who are, you know, plucked off their bus and disappeared, and friends who were beaten by the soldiers, and friends who are, you know, their husbands are taken away for a year, you know, in prison, and kind of these bogus charges, and the way that they're traumatized, and they lose a year of income, and they lose, you know, my friend wasn't able to witness the birth of his daughter because he was in an Israeli prison for something he never, you know, that pretty self-evidently he didn't do. So, you know, all of these things together, it takes a toll after a while.
And obviously, on a magnitude of 1,000 times worse for those people that are there.
Of course. I mean, I wrote right in the book that I can't imagine, like, if I can barely deal with it for 2 years, you know, imagine living with it decade after decade. And it's not like, you know, as an American, I have many more privileges than a Palestinian, as far as I can travel without a permit. I can go anywhere in the West Bank that I want without worrying about, you know, getting an Israeli permit. I can leave the country whenever I want. And it's not my mother. It's not my sister-in-law. It's not my, you know, nieces and nephews who are being treated this way. So almost everyone who visits the West Bank, they say the same thing. They say, I can't believe Palestinians aren't more violent, given everything that I'm learning about what they go through.
We're talking with Pamela Olson. She is author of the book Fast Times in Palestine, A Love Affair with a Homeless Homeland. Talk about how you got involved with Dr. Mustafa Barghouti's 2005 presidential campaign.
Sure. That was another interesting curveball. So about 3 months after I was just getting used to this journalism job, I was kind of finally settling into it. Yasser Arafat died, and I went to his funeral. I read about that in the book. And then I go to JU's for the post-Ramadan holidays, which were right after he died. And when I'm harvesting olives, a friend walks up to me and says, you know, Yabam, I have some bad news. A friend of mine has been shot in the back by Israeli soldiers. He was taken away into a hospital in Israel. They won't tell us what his condition is. His parents are, you know, going crazy. They want to visit him, but the hospital or the army says you can't visit him unless you go to the hospital to get a paper that proves what his condition is. So it's like this perfect catch 22. So I say, well, look, you know, I can go do it. I can get the paper. So it should be a relatively simple thing, right? I mean, the hospital is about 10 miles away as the crow flies. But of course, I have to go all the way down to Ramallah and then cross the Kalandia checkpoint and then go to Jerusalem and then go to the Jerusalem Central bus station and then take a bus all the way back up to this town that's 10 miles away. It takes about 6 hours with all the checkpoints and everything. But I finally get to the hospital and I'm like, okay, finally I'm here. Shouldn't be that hard from here on out. And then it's just they send me in these bureaucratic circles. They say, oh, we don't give papers like that for people like this. And then they're like, well, we give papers, but, you know, we can't do it today. And, oh, well, yeah, we can do it today, but the doctor's busy. Well, she's not really busy, but, you know, we have to send it to a settlement. And the settlement, you know, we fax it to the settlement and we get the paper faxed to the settlement. And the settlement's like, we don't know when he's going to leave. Maybe he'll be out tomorrow. And then his parents are going to be here. And then what are they going to do? And you're like, his spine is broken. He's not going anywhere. So anyway, it was just this nightmare of sort of hostile bureaucracy. And I finally get it done. I get back to J.U.S. I get back to Ramallah, back to my job. I just want to kind of relax into my job, whatever. And then Dr. Mustafa Barghouti calls an emergency meeting after work. And I'm like, oh, great. Because I had this plan. I was going to get some Chinese takeout, go home. You know, there's an Angelina Jolie action movie on that I wanted to watch just to sort of forget about things for a while. And he's like, so I have decided to run for president against Mahmoud Abbas. And I'm thinking, okay, great, whatever, run for president. I'm sure you can do it while I'm eating Chinese takeout. But then he says, okay, I need somebody to volunteer to be my foreign press coordinator. And I look around, and all the other foreigners have plans to be out of the country for the Christmas holidays. I'm the only one who doesn't, the only native English speaker who doesn't. So I'm like, oh, great, okay, fine, I can do it. And at the time, it was kind of this sense of duty, like, okay, I guess I should do it. But then I was like, wait a minute. You know, my boss is running for president, and I'm, you know, offered a front row seat. I mean, this is actually pretty exciting. So for the next 2 months, not only am I doing my full-time job, I'm doing another full-time job, which is representing the campaign to the entire world's international media. And it was a pretty fascinating experience.
Talk about that more. What stands out from doing that?
What stands out is that, I guess, you know, I mentioned I went to work with him to see what kind of forces are arrayed against a candidate like this. And it was very interesting to see that, of course, Fateh, you know, Mahmoud Abbas's party, they don't want anybody upsetting their apple cart. Like, they have this kind of domination over not just sort of administration under occupation, but also preferential business deals and, you know, VIP checkpoint passes. And they can do all these things that ordinary Palestinians aren't allowed to do. And they, you know, they're kind of comfortable in their position. And it was increasingly clear that people are kind of fed up with this sort of corruption / you know, the fact that they're comfortable under occupation and nobody else is. You know, I mean, it's kind of this divide that people get increasingly tired of. So it seemed like it was kind of a ripe moment to elect somebody new and to try something else. But, you know, Fateh, I mean, they control the state TV, so something like 94% of state television coverage was allocated to, like, pro-Abbas messages. Abbas policemen would kind of harass, campaign workers in various places around the West Bank and Gaza. And then there was the Israeli government and army that were kind of, they would say in public that, oh, of course we're going to allow all the presidential candidates to travel freely, and of course we're going to let everyone get to the polls when it's, you know, election day. And it speaks volumes that they're talking about allowing presidential candidates to move freely. I mean, it's clear who's actually in charge in this area. But even that wasn't true. I mean, he had to sneak into East Jerusalem several times to campaign there. One of his campaign workers was interrogated when he was putting up flyers. The Israeli army wouldn't let him inside the Hebron Old City. He was allowed into the Gaza Strip once. Another time he was rejected. He was not allowed. And, you know, East Jerusalem has 250,000 voters. The Gaza Strip has 1.5 million voters. To be kind of cut off from these constituencies, you know, in the middle of a campaign, it's very difficult to, you know, I mean, it's difficult enough to try to make a difference in this, you know, cynical society where everyone's been through, like, there's people are so sick of politics and so cynical about politics. And to try to, you know, go to all these villages and just be sort of cut off at the pass in so many different ways. In one case, he was actually stopped at a checkpoint, and everybody in his vehicle was taken out and, like, sort of roughed up by Israeli soldiers. Like, one of the men was choked. He was hit on the back of his back with the butt of a gun. Another one was hit, I think, behind the ear with the butt of a gun. And then after this, they were forced to lay on the ground for, like, an hour and 15 minutes. And if they tried to talk to each other, they were hit again. So anyway, they finally let them go, and they went to the hospital to check, make sure everyone's, you know, no concussions or whatever. And, of course, our campaign wrote a press release and sent it to all of our press contacts. And some people actually wrote about it. And I was, you know, especially excited to read the New York Times. I'm like, you know, finally they're going to have to, I mean, this kind of such an outrageous thing. They're going to have to expose this kind of abuse for once. And then I opened the New York Times, and it's kind of buried in an unrelated article about a small girl being killed in the Gaza Strip by Israeli gunfire. It essentially just says, elsewhere, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti claims to have been involved in a scuffle with Israeli soldiers. And, like, that's kind of the extent of the coverage. And I called the journalist. I said, hey, you know, we sent you a press release. Why didn't you cover this in a more detailed slash truthful way? And he said, oh, we just didn't have time to go into that kind of detail. And I didn't say this, but I was thinking it, like, if an Israeli presidential candidate had been dragged out of his car and beaten by Palestinian security services, I'm sure he would have found some time. So that's just one tiny example of the kind of, you know, things that you're dealing with when you're trying to, you know, report what's actually happening on the ground in Palestine.
And was the New York Times treatment of coverage of that incident, was that typical for U.S. corporate media coverage of his campaign?
Very typical. And not only, I mean, they seemed always preemptively to dismiss him. It was always long shot candidate Dr. Mustafa Barghouti or dark horse candidate Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. And he kept saying, like, you know, you're predetermining this election without even, you know, it's not very respectful of Palestinians to tell them, you know, who their candidates are and what their chances are. But, and of course, the Arab world as well, like the Arab media was also, you know, a lot of them, now there's kind of Arab Spring in the air. At the time, it was pretty much mostly sort of dictators beholden to the West. And they didn't want any kind of, you know, too many people to get too many ideas about representative democracy. So they kind of kept it quiet, too. So it was really an uphill battle the whole way.
Just about 5 minutes left. So eventually you came back here to the U.S. and you spent a while working in D.C. Can you touch on that?
Sure. I worked at a think tank that advised both Congress and the Defense Department, an independent federally funded research and development center. And, you know, I went there partly to kind of, you know, I had explored culture in the Middle East and found it to be very edifying, very enlightening. And from the Middle East, the culture of Washington seems sort of equally alien to, you know, that the Middle Eastern culture used to. And you think, like, how do so many supposedly college-educated, you know, people come up with these ideas that seem so self-evidently bad for everybody? And I wanted to understand that culture and also see if I could influence it, see if I could, you know, bring a very level-headed view from what I'd, you know, what I'd seen in the area and what made sense to me after living there for 2 years. And it was a definitely an education, the way that people are very locked into, there's always this sort of, in the air, there's kind of a conventional wisdom that everybody knows not to go against. It's unspoken, but if you sort of, you know, pop up and say, oh, I'm going to talk sense right now instead of go along with the, you know, dominant narrative, you're not invited to conferences, you're not promoted, you're not, you know, taken seriously, you're called naive, all these, there's all these different ways to marginalize people who don't go along with whatever's in the air at the moment. And I certainly experienced that myself. So I write a little, I sort of narrativize the way that this sort of incestuous beltway bubble, like, keeps itself going with these terrible ideas. And, yeah, also from D.C., I was watching history unfold in Palestine, you know, the election, the Hamas election victory, how it actually happened versus what Washington was saying about it. You know, the kidnapping of Gilad Shalit and how it was just, it was such a big deal. And, of course, it is a big deal when a young man is taken away from his family and held without charge or trial for many years. But what nobody was talking about was there are several thousand Palestinians in the same situation, taken away from their family, often for either bogus charges or no charge or trial at all. And, you know, people don't realize how that tears away at the fabric of Palestinian life when everybody knows that anybody can disappear at any moment for any reason or for no reason. And there's no recourse. There's no legal recourse. It's not up to them. You know, watching what happened in Lebanon in the summer of 2006 versus, you know, what everyone was, how everyone was talking about it around me, and just comparing and contrasting, you know, reality with Washington, I guess.
So you were actually for a while there trying to change things from inside, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. It was worth a shot, you know, but it was more like, you know, when you dance with the devil, you know, you don't change the devil changes you. And, you know, by the time I had been there for sort of a year and a half, I realized I caught myself kind of censoring myself and kind of going along with this whole culture. And then I was like, I'm out of here. I'm not, this isn't good. So then that's when I decided to, you know, stop doing that. And well, first of all, I went back to Palestine for a while just to kind of recalibrate and sort of get back to reality world a little bit and sort of feel like a human being again. And, you know, then I was ready finally to write this book.
And so your work is from the outside now, so to speak.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really difficult to change Washington from the inside. Something Barack Obama said in Israel when he visited really struck me, which was he said, look, we're not going to take any risks. You know, we're not going to do, you have to push us to do it. You have to tell us to do it. And I'm like, well, last I checked, leaders are supposed to lead, but they're not going to do it. I mean, there's no culture of leadership in Washington in any kind of good direction. So, yeah, I figured that we're going to have to pressure people from the outside. And I thought, you know, a good starting point is looking at reality from a more realistic, you know, viewpoint. So that's why I wrote this book. And I wrote it not just to get information across, but also to be, you know, like there's romance and adventure and suspense and humor and all these things that make reading actually fun. So, and, you know, people tell me that, you know, once they start reading it, they'll stay up too late to try to finish it because there's all these, you know, things in the air that they want to find out how it's resolved. And because I could write another dry academic book about how miserable things are in Palestine, but nobody's going to read it. I mean, I don't read books like that. I don't want, you know, when I have free time, I want to read something with a little bit of readability, I guess you could say. So yeah, I thought, and I was really shocked, actually, that so few people have done this, like have written something about this region that's actually fun to read. So yeah, I hope that can have an effect on people's opinion of what's going on.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.